All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm taking advantage of every damn minute today because we got a very important show. At the back end of the show, you'll be listening to a talk given by Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party just a little while ago in New York City, and the title of that talk is Taking the Bullseye Off the Backs of Our Young People, and it fits right in with the whole theme of the show because what we're going to focus on in the whole first half of the show is the murder of Trayvon Martin. It's the one-year anniversary of the murder of Trayvon Martin, and I'm going to run a couple of pieces, both to remind people of what happened there and to also sort of nudge people into remembering that we do have to stand up against these kinds of terrible assaults on humanity, terrible assaults on black youth, terrible assaults on justice, and demand justice for Trayvon Martin and an end to this kind of terror. So the middle of the show is going to be an interview I did with Lee Ernesto, a reporter for Revolution Newspaper, talking about the way that Trayvon was murdered once and then murdered once again by the police and the press. And that was an important analysis of what was going on in the Trayvon Martin case. And opening the show up is a section that I had broadcast last summer. But since this is the one-year anniversary of the murder of Trayvon Martin, I thought it'd be good to rebroadcast this. Some of you may have heard it. A lot of you probably didn't hear it. But this is, I went down to Sanford, Florida, a couple of months after Trayvon was murdered. I found myself gaining access to the compound, to the townhouse complex where he was murdered. And I was able to retrace his steps from the 7-Eleven where he came back into the place where he was staying and visiting, armed with a pack of Skittles and an Arizona iced tea. And he was gunned down, savagely gunned down, by vigilante wannabe cop George Zimmerman, who was then walked in the front door of the police station and walked out the back door of the police station. And Trayvon Martin is dead. Never forget that. So listen up. Let's start where life ended for Trayvon Martin, the spot where he was murdered by a self-appointed neighborhood watch vigilante. It's a relaxed 15-minute stroll, max, from the 7-Eleven, where Trayvon loaded up on Skittles and an Arizona iced tea, to the retreat at Twin Lakes, the gated community where his life was stolen. It sits in what's called the suburban core of Sanford, Florida. Behind walls and a black iron fence, it's a community of mixed nationalities and classes. Outside one of the gates to the complex, people have built a memorial to Trayvon around a school zone sign. All kinds of teddy bears, footballs, packs of Skittles, and cans of Arizona iced tea are bunched up with personal messages, cards, religious texts, and photos. We stopped for a moment to take it in and left behind a photo collage of all the banners of the No More Generations quote from Bob Avakian, signed by hundreds of people around the country in solidarity with the people of Sanford. One of the walk-through gates was missing a lock, so we decided to explore. Streets lined with identical cookie-cutter houses wrap around each other. And it's quiet, a deadly, stifling quiet, everything muffled like a thick, wet blanket had been dropped down over the complex. It was early afternoon on a Saturday, and there were no kids' voices to be heard, and only a few spotted for a second standing outside their house. Nothing else. Sterile and empty. Walking those streets, I could almost feel the terror that Trayvon must have felt being tailed and hunted like human prey by George Zimmerman. We turned off the street into a narrow sidewalk that ran between two rows of houses. The sidewalk was separated from the back doors of the houses by small grass yards. It was on this sidewalk, only 70 feet from where he was staying, that Trayvon was cut down, his child morphing into adult face, a combination of beauty, hope, and innocence, meshing with newly gained scars of experience growing up black in the USA, drew in its last breath face down on this grass. called out to a black man watching over his barbecue grill from inside his house. Trayvon had been killed within earshot of his place, and yet the man didn't know about the killing until the following night. He explained that everybody pretty much sticks to themselves in this neighborhood. They don't mingle, and they rarely talk to their neighbors. A black woman who I stopped as she drove through another gate into the complex told a similar story. She had gone to the community meeting held at the complex a couple of days after the murder and said that the people were upset at what happened. But she said that people were upset and afraid that there was an armed man roaming the complex with the freedom to shoot their children. She said it seemed like no one in that meeting had any idea where George Zimmerman came from and who gave him the authority to patrol the complex. She didn't know what happened later because she doesn't know too many people in the complex. But there's no mystery here. What happened that horrible night comes up out of the soil of slavery and the continuing inhuman oppression of black people under this system. Six public housing projects in Sanford have been closed down over the last couple of years. Some of the people pushed out of these projects used Section 8 federal housing vouchers to rent homes in gated communities, housing that became available to them because of the tanking economy and the housing market crash. According to local news stories, the people who moved into these complexes with Section 8 vouchers, including the one where Trayvon Martin was killed, were clearly less than welcome. At the retreat at Twin Lakes, a rash of home break-ins occurred in September, and George Zimmerman was unleashed to form his neighborhood patrol and hunt down suspicious people. 6 months later, Trayvon Martin lay dead in the grass. I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Lee Ernesto. Lee's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's been writing a lot about the murder of Trayvon Martin and the killing lies that have been done, the fierce counterattack that this system has unleashed against Trayvon Martin. You know, and you know, people look at this, and anyone you talk to, anyone you see, you know, you talk to these days knows that you look at it and you say, you know, this is a giant hole ripped in the fabric of the society where people are beginning to see things. They're standing up. They're beginning to question things. There's a whole change in the atmosphere in terms of people, you know, really standing up and expressing their outrage, going out in the streets and saying loud and together that we're all Trayvon Martin. And at the same time, this system has launched a counterattack. And in some ways, it did it from the very beginning, but it seems to be like in a couple of different stages. And Lee's here to talk with us about that. Lee, welcome to the show.
Hey. Good to talk to you, Michael.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this. You know, one of the things that from the very beginning, and this is something that anybody who paid attention to this just had to be extremely angry about and enraged. And I know I was, you know, throwing things at the television and the radio. But, you know, there's this whole question of from the very beginning, and you wrote about this in a Revolution newspaper a couple of weeks ago, from the very beginning, this point about the dehumanization, the degradation, the criminalization of black youth was concentrated up not just in what happened to Trayvon, how he was murdered simply for being a black kid in a hoodie, but also in how it was treated in the immediate aftermath of that. How the system actually went immediately into that mode. He was a criminal. He deserved to be killed. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, I mean, even at the scene of the crime, the whole way the police treated this from the very beginning, they treated Trayvon Martin like he was the criminal, even as he lay dead. They didn't charge Zimmerman with anything, accepting his claim right away that he acted in self-defense, even though he was standing there with a gun, and Trayvon Martin was, quote-unquote, armed with what? Skittles and iced tea. And, you know, and there was this whole 911 that had gone on where it was very clear that Zimmerman had, from the very beginning, had, you know, at the very least, been the one that had been the aggressor in this. Now, there's a lot of things we don't know what happened that night, but it was very clear that from the 911 accounts that have been released and that we do know, that he, you know, saw this young black youth. He was wearing, and the dispatcher asked, what is he wearing? He says he's wearing a hoodie, and he looks suspicious. He's walking around. He got his hands in his pocket, and the dispatcher said, are you following him? And Zimmerman says, yes. And the dispatcher very clearly said, we don't need you to be doing that. and Zimmerman did not follow those instructions. And when the police, and we don't know exactly what happened, but we do know that there was some kind of struggle. There was yelling, according to eyewitnesses, and then Trayvon's life was over. And when the police got there, how did they respond to this? They immediately accepted pretty much Zimmerman's claim that he acted in self-defense. They took him in and questioned him and then released him. The police told Trayvon's father that one of the reasons that they didn't arrest Zimmerman was that he had a clean record, and that turned out to actually not be true. The police corrected a witness who said she had heard a young voice crying for help, and they corrected her, telling her, oh, no, you heard Zimmerman calling for help, even though there have been three other witnesses who said they heard the sound of a child, or at least a young person, before they heard the gunshot wounds. The police did a background check on Trayvon Martin as he lay dead, but not on Zimmerman. They tested Trayvon Martin's blood for alcohol and drugs, but not Zimmerman's. And they didn't even talk to Trayvon Martin's girlfriend, who had been on the phone with him before and during part of the attack. So this was, even from the very beginning, the whole way that they treated this was to treat Trayvon as if he was the criminal, even though he was the one that was laying dead on the ground.
And in spite of that, actually, and maybe even attached to that or coming up off of that in response to that, this time people didn't just back up. There's been like just a tremendous outpouring of anger and, you know, all kinds of resistance expressed in relation to this. I mean, the outrage of all these things that you've just talked about in terms of what the police and the system had done in the wake of the murder of Trayvon. And then also just the very fact that Trayvon carrying Skittles and a can of Arizona iced tea and going to his pop's house to watch the playoffs, the NBA playoffs. You know, think about this. When he's going to watch a basketball game with his pops, what happens? You know, and people just realizing that this could have been any black youth in America today. And it's not something that's out of the ordinary. It's part of the ordinary way that people live, you know. And I know in the revolution, there's been a tremendous amount of coverage of, you know, even people talking about, you know, his friends down there and people from the neighborhood talking about what their life is like. And you begin to see what Trayvon and what happened to him, what that concentrates. It's very heavy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the first article that I wrote in Revolution was the ordinariness of this kind of thing and the ordinariness of the whole history of the oppression of black people in the USA. And I think one of the things that has come out in relationship to this and that is an element in what has sparked this protest from coast to coast is that it's not just, I mean, there is the element of it could have been me, it could have been my brother, and that is very powerful. I mean, we sent a reporter, a Revolution newspaper sent a reporter to Stanford right after this happened, and I really encourage people to read, you know, all of our coverage, including the coverage of interviews that our reporter did with people in Stanford. And you just really feel this outpouring of bitterness of people, you know, saying, you know, talking about how this happens all the time. And it's not just in Stanford. It's in cities and towns all across this country. So there's that element to it. But there's also this question of the whole history of this. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting, that people all over the place were talking about, were bringing up the question of Emmett Till, you know, the whole story of Emmett Till, who was killed by racists in 1955 for the quote-unquote crime of whistling at a white woman. There again, you know, more than 50 years ago, the lynching of Emmett Till and how there again, the cover-up by the powers be, you know, how this was perpetrated, condoned, and covered up by the system, and that people, not just in one city or in one place or by a few people, but this was being brought up in a lot of different places. So there's this whole sense of that this being just the latest in a whole chain, in a whole history of the oppression of black people, you know, and there was a certain kind of like, look, we have to stand up and put an end to this. Now there's a lot of question of how do you do that? What is the cause of this, and how are we really going to put an end to that?
Well, we'll get into
that. The questioning of the legitimacy of a system that is just, that this goes on and on and on, I think there's a very important moment here.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that in a little bit. And I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And I'm talking today with Lee Ernesto, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about the terrible counterattack against Trayvon Martin. And as his mom said, they killed him and now they're trying to kill his reputation. You know, Lee, one of the things, this comment from Trayvon's mother comes in the wake of all of this stuff that's going on. You know, there's a huge thing, as you put it in your most recent article, there's a lot. They've actually planted all kinds of poisonous so-called evidence in the court of public opinion. There's been a major, major counterattack in trying to sway public opinion, responding to the kind of outrage that's out there, trying to undercut it, all this other stuff. But really, in terms of the legitimacy of the system, recover some of that sense of legitimacy, trying to retake their ground around legitimacy. And they're doing it in the court of public opinion. And there's been some really disgusting stuff. I recently saw that, you know, an idiot like Ted Nugent, you know, somehow has become a, you know, commentator worthy of talking about, you know, well, what's really right and wrong here and who was really in danger there. And it's just insane stuff that's going on all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think it's interesting to see is how these counterattacks, the necessity that the system has. I mean, one thing is there has been some contention within even the ruling circles over how to deal with this. I mean, you did have this phenomenon, you know, that even within the media and even within the ruling circles of some, you know, different contention over how to deal with this. I mean, you had certain ruling class forces who were getting up there in the House of Representatives wearing hoodies and speaking out against racial profiling, right? But at the same time, you did have this concerted effort to spin a whole reactionary narrative against Trayvon. And I think part of it is that you did have this whole outpouring and this whole, you know, it's very dangerous for the system that this has happened, that there has been this kind of outpouring, including the fact that that you have these moments like this. Here you have, for decades, they've been spinning all this demonization of black youth, you know, together with the mass incarceration. And you got forces like Bill Cosby out there saying, look, these youth, they're a bunch of thugs, they're into drugs, you know, they deserve whatever they get, and you should be afraid of them, and the middle class forces and all this. And a lot of people, frankly, have bought this. But then you have these moments like this where, for the moment, people see things a little bit more clearly, including people in the middle class. And they see, they even get out in the streets and stand with the people. I mean, you know, some of these demonstrations, you had all kinds of people, all different nationalities, and including people in the middle classes. And so you have the need of the system. Certain ruling class forces really see the need to get out there and to reverse that.
I want to actually let people know that we are talking with Lee Ernesto from Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the counterattack, the serious counterattack, and as Trayvon's mother said, the attempt, first they kill her son, and then they assassinate his reputation. They're trying to assassinate his reputation. You know, look, if this doesn't get you angry, it should. People need to be actually really considering the nature of this whole attack and what's behind it. And that's what we're talking with Lee about. She's been writing in Revolution Newspaper about this. And it's a very, you know, it's something that really is something for each and every one of us to be thinking about today. And if it doesn't make you understand how horrible the world is, and on top of that, make you start to search for and to seek out the kind of, you know, the kind of understanding that we need to have in order to get you know, to deal with this. How many more, you know, think about it. We have the Dred Scott case. We have Emmett Till. We have, you know, James Byrd Jr. We have all of this stuff going on all over the place. And now we have Trayvon Martin. And it continues to this day. It continues. Well, don't you think that there's a point where we need to actually have the question raised? Don't you think there's a point where we need to have the question raised that we're where does it stop and how does it stop? Lee?
And I was just saying, you know, we get this whole story, you know, that, oh, no, it's more complicated. You know, Trayvon was suspended from school. He was caught defacing a locker. He was caught with a baggie, and his backpack was marijuana residue. He had a burglary tool, you know, and what was that? A screwdriver. And so they say, all of a sudden, this whole narrative comes back, you know, and it's aimed at basically telling people, you know, bringing back this whole narrative that not just Trayvon, but Trayvon, who is an example, yes, of what we've been telling you for decades, of how these black youth are the demonization of black youth as criminals. And yes, maybe George Zimmerman was right to be suspicious of him. George Zimmerman was right to be fearful of his life. And maybe George Zimmerman was right to kill Trayvon Martin. This is the whole narrative that's now being spun. And even if, I mean, they're hoping that even if you don't buy that whole thing, that maybe it'll put enough questions out there to put a lid on some of this protest.
And it's very interesting, too, because there is this demonization, continuing demonization and criminalization of Trayvon Martin. But there's also a whole thing that's going on around basically the rehabilitation of George Zimmerman to a certain extent, you know, where they've resurrected pictures of him from a long time ago where he looks like, you know, he looks like a fine, upstanding businessman, you know, and as opposed to the picture that earlier came out of him, you know, where he looked a little like a vigilante wannabe cop neighborhood watch guy who would trail black youth, you know, for looking suspicious, supposedly. You know, now he's like a fine, upstanding citizen. And, you know, of course, he was correct to do this, you know, and there's a whole thing about this poisonous evidence. And it's right. I think it's very important that, you know, what you point out is that, look, this is all lies, straight up, just straight up lies, you know. And then there's a question of, again, you know, people confront this, and you confront this continuously. You confront it from the beginning of slavery and all that horror that happened there. You confront the Dred Scott ruling. You confront, you know, Emmett Till. You confront James Byrd Jr. Then you come up to Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin, and all the thousands of people, of young black people and black people in particular, black people, including these days more and more black youth. You know, you confront that and you have to ask a question.
And so, Leonesto from Revolution Newspaper, I'll put the question to you.
Where does it come from and how do you stop this? Are we going to have somebody else? Is there a way we can actually say, no, we don't want to have any more Trayvon Martins? And in relation to that, I'd like you to talk about it in some of the time that we have left. Is like your view on that, including this, there's been a call that came out in Revolution Newspaper for a day of outrage around this. And I'd like you to try and tie that stuff together. What do people do if they want to get out there?
Well, I just want to say really quickly, I think that people have to get beyond also the George Zimmerman. You know, people are, you know, calling for the arrest of Zimmerman. But I think even the way that they're this rewriting of Zimmerman, I mean, in some ways it's to their advantage to keep the spotlight on him as opposed to the system that created George Zimmerman, you know what I'm saying, on all of what you're bringing in, the whole history of this. So I think one of the things that this day of outrage is it's talking about how it is an outrage on top of countless outrages. And it talks about, you know, this is a call that has been put out for a day of outrage on April 10th. And it talks about how the Trayvon Martin murder is an outrage on top of countless outrages. And it's right and inspiring that people are waging protests around this, and that people are really cutting through the whitewash and the cover-up and the lies around this, and see that this is not an isolated incident, but yet another in a long line of killing of black people, and that we do have to stand up, we have to fight against it, and that there is a moment here to seize, a moment to really build a movement, to really finally put an end to all the horrors that come from this system. But how many more times are we going to have to put up with this? And I think that you know, as the call says, it says, make April 10th a day of outrage. Seize the time wherever and whenever there is a chance to act with daring and creativity, and have all that feed into a movement that will not stop until the whole system that is responsible for the deaths of so many here and around the world is no more. And I think this is going to be a very important day for all those people who have been getting out into the streets on this to really take all that anger and to take it to another level in terms of, you know, as the slogan at the end of this call puts it, fight the power and transform the people for revolution.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point. And it does have to be, I mean, you think about this in relation to it, because I'm constantly confronted with people that say, look, I want to actually, you know, I want to take part. I want to stand up against this. And I'm looking for, you know, an answer to why this is happening and how to stop it, where it's coming from and how to stop it. And people are dealing with all kinds of questions. I mean, you mentioned in a couple of places some of the big questions that people are coming up with. You know, the whole idea that, you know, the question that people have of what we're told all the time is that there's this senseless violence of black on black, you know, crime and black on black violence. And that is senseless, as you've pointed out. And yet at the same time, what's opened up today is not only people beginning to see and question the legitimacy of some of the, you know, the system and what it does, but and also, you know, really see the outrage around this and protesting against it, but also seeing how things could be different, seeing these different levels like you were talking about, people getting together. But it's also very important that actually in this mix that people really begin to look to what is going to end all this stuff once and for all. And I think that's got to be something that, to me, it seems like what you're saying, fight the power and transform the people for revolution. People really got to be getting into this question of
revolution. What do we mean, and how's it going to happen? And what, you know, will this really bring an end to it? I think that's an extremely important part of the day, as well as people coming out into the streets and fighting. Like you say, people do have to do that. If they don't do it, they'll be broken. All right, Lee, I want to thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Okay. Take care now. All right. We've just been talking with Lee Ernesto, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about the heinous assault on Trayvon Martin. First he was murdered, and then he was murdered again by the police and the press. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to a talk given by Carl Dix, so stay tuned.
The dark brown shades of my skin only add color to my tears. Oh, oh, that splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Oh, 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 oh. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black?
Uh-huh. Welcome back. That's Syl Johnson with Is It Because I'm Black? Right now, we're going to move into listening to a talk given by Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party just a little while ago in New York City. And that talk is entitled, Taking the Bullseye Off of the Backs of Our Young People.
Let's get into taking the bullseye off the backs of our young people, ending stop and frisk, racial profiling, and mass incarceration once and for all. Now, to get into this, I want to go back to when we were starting this civil disobedience campaign and just tell you one out of very many stories that we ran into. I'm out in Brooklyn building for a protest out in Brownsville around stop and frisk, and a young woman, a teenager, walking along with her bike comes up and she says to me, I got stopped and frisked one night last week. I was riding my bike home from my late shift at Burger King. The cops stopped me, and they said they wanted to frisk me because there was a lot of activity of prostitutes in that area. Now, stop and frisk is not the way to find prostitutes. I mean, what are you going to frisk on somebody that shows you that they're a prostitute? I mean, I haven't paid a lot of attention, so maybe prostitutes go looking for John's riding around on bicycles, but that's not what would occur to me. So that's one story. Let me give you one more story. Monday night, I got an email from a woman who has been working with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network here in New York City, and she told us of her and a friend being accosted by police. They were taking flyers over to another friend's house, another person who works with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, but that's not why the cops accosted them. They were just stopping cars and wanting to know what people had in the cars. So they were just delivering these flyers. So while the cops were talking to the woman in the flyer, the guy gets out and walks because they're almost to where they're delivering the flyers. Turns out to have been a big mistake because then the cops accosted him, sicked a dog on him, knocked the flyers out of his hand, knocked his phone out of his hand. Then they ended up arresting him for disorderly conduct and littering. The flyers that he dropped were decided, okay, you were littering. So this person who sent the email goes to the police station to try to get him out. The desk sergeant asks her, what do you think about stop and frisk? She told him the truth, probably in a little more descriptive language than I'm going to use, but she told him she opposed it and had something to do with her rights being violated by it. The desk sergeant says, I don't give a damn about your rights. Get the hell out of here. That's how that went. Now, see, these are two stories out of hundreds of thousands. Because, look, the NYPD in 2011 stopped and frisked 684,000 people. Most of them were black or Latino, 85%. Most of them were also male, even though I told you the stories about two women, because they're just kind of sticking in my mind. For the first quarter of 2012, they stopped and frisked more than 200,000 people. The numbers dropped after that, and we can talk about that and why and what that means. But what's been pretty consistent with this is that more than five out of six people they stop are black or Latino, and about 9 out of 10 people that they stop, the cops can't even come up with a reason to arrest them or write them a ticket. A lot of times people say, well, 9 out of 10 of them were doing nothing wrong. But some of the 1 out of 10 that get arrested or tickets written on them are also doing nothing wrong. Like the brother last night who was delivering leaflets and got accosted by the cops and knocked the leaflets out of his hands. And then, of course, he's littering. That's not something wrong. The people doing that and even less than that end up getting arrested, getting summonses written on them, and all this kind of stuff. Stop and frisk is about inflicting indignity and everyday brutality on oppressed people in this city. See, and New York City is one of the few cities that has written down a policy like this. I think Philadelphia has a written down stop and frisk policy. San Francisco, Oakland area, one of the mayors there is talking about bringing stop and frisk in as an official policy. But look, even in the cities where they don't have an official policy, they practice the same kind of racial profiling. That's what this comes down to, just racial profiling, deciding that people are criminals based upon the color of their skin. Because when you look at the reasons that they give, furtive movements is the one most often cited. You tell me what that means. But then here's another one. A very often cited reason is the suspect looked away when we looked at it. But almost as often cited reason is suspect looked directly in my face when I looked at it. So in other words, suspect was a suspect no matter what the f*** he did. That's why I call it racial profiling. That's what it comes down to.
You're listening to Carl Dix and his talk in New York City a little while ago entitled Taking the Bullseye Off the Backs of Our Young People.
On top of this, you've got mass incarceration. 2.4 million people warehoused in prison. 8 times as many as 1971. Again, over 60% of them black or Latino. This results from wars on drugs, wars on crime, which are actually wars on oppressed people, mainly on black and Latino people. Laws passed by Congress that specifically target the inner cities, like the crack powder cocaine disparity. Congress passed a law mandating 100-to-1 sentencing disparity, with crack cocaine getting the 100 times the penalty of powder cocaine. You had to have 100 times as much powder cocaine to get the same penalty as crack cocaine. What was the scientific basis for that? Well, they brought 2 crackheads in to testify before Congress. And these crackheads said, crack is the most addictive thing in the world, man. I go crazy when I don't get my crack. Now, I mean, I don't know about you, but I would not take the testimony of 2 crackheads. It's, you know, they're crack addicts and they need help. In other words, here's the point. They weren't going for any scientific evidence. It was just like a little fig leaf to cover what they wanted to do, which was to target people in the inner city. The wars on crime also get targeted there. That's where law enforcement focuses on trapping people up in the courts and in the jails. Then on top of this, you got the people killed by cops. And on average, since the 1990s, when we formed I was a co-founder also of the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And that coalition worked on a project called Stolen Lives, documenting people killed by the police, which we had to do on a grassroots basis because it turns out that no institution in the United States admits to collecting that information. If it's collected, they don't tell you about it. So we had to figure it out ourselves. And on that basis, we found that cops kill on average 200 plus people every year. Again, most of them are black or Latino. And more than half of them were unarmed and doing nothing wrong, involved in no criminal activity when they were killed by police. But despite this fact, it is exceedingly rare that a killer cop gets punished in any way. And when they do get punished, it just comes down to a slap on the wrist. And we do have to add to this killings by racist vigilantes. And that's especially important this month, February 26th, 1 year since the racist wannabe cop vigilante George Zimmerman murdered Trayvon Martin. And again, let's just look at how that came down. He saw this young man walking along, talking on a cell phone, wearing a hoodie. And he decided he must be up to no good. What was the basis for that? It came down to the color of his skin. That's what that was. That's why Zimmerman stalked him, led to him ending up killing him. And then it also had a lot to do with the police finding Zimmerman standing over the dead body of Trayvon, taking him into custody and walking him into the front door of the police station and out the back door in very short time, deciding that nothing wrong had been done. And I'm going to come back to that in a little bit, but we have to take that into account. And then also there's the murder of Jordan Davis, also in Florida, by a white man who decided that Jordan and his friends were playing their music too loud. This was back in last November. And then the guy fled the scene. Then when he turned himself in because they got his license plate number, he cited Florida's Stand Your Ground law, just like Zimmerman.
You're listening to Carl Dix and his talk in New York City a little while ago entitled Taking the Bullseye Off the Backs of Our Young People.
All of this is why I talk about the criminalization of whole sections of people in the society, especially young blacks and Latinos. Here's how the law enforcement system comes at them: guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. See, and we gotta bring in that part about if they can survive, because Romare Graham, who was killed on February 2nd of 2012, when you look at the cop's story about why they were after him, they said he had a suspicious bulge in his waistband. In other words, they wanted to stop and frisk him. They just didn't catch up to him until he was in his house, and they ended up murdering him. So our youth don't always get to survive to prove their innocence. We could also talk about Amadou Diallo in that context. See, and this is why I say the system has got a bullseye on the backs of our youth. In his talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, citing someone who had studied the history of black people and lynching, said that in the era of lynching leading up to World War II, every black male had a death sentence hanging over his head. This expert said, this historian said, it might be carried out or it might not, but it was always there. And that's what black people were up against in that period. But when we talk about today, every black and Latino youth has that bullseye, that a similar death sentence potentially hanging over their heads. It might get carried out, it might not. And I say that because when you look at the circumstances around Trayvon Martin, what was it? Was it that this was a youth who was doing something wrong? Was there something about him beyond his black skin that led to this? The same thing about Romare Graham, Amadou Diallo, Brother Cuevas, who got killed by a cop who was called in by Cuevas and some other people because their store was being robbed up in the Bronx, and the cops shot one of the victims of the robbery, not the robbers. That's what this comes down to. This concentrates the oppression that has been heaped on black people since the first Africans were dragged to these shores in slavery chains centuries ago. The forms of this oppression may have changed, but the horrors it has come down to remain constant. And these are horrors that were built into the fabric of this capitalist system. I'm going to talk about this a little more later. But look, if this was the only thing wrong with this setup, it would be reason enough to want to get rid of it through revolution and build a totally different and far better society and world in its place. And it is far from the only problem. I mean, look, 10 million children die every year of starvation and preventable disease. The reason they don't get the food or the medicine and treatment that they need is because there is no profit for it. No capitalist can make a buck on it. There's the degradation and brutality that are inflicted on women here in this country and around the world. There's the death by long distance that gets rained down on people in other lands by the drone missiles that the U.S. sends hurtling down on their countries. There's the ravaging of the very environment of the planet. Uprooting these and all the other horrors once and for all, it's going to take revolution, nothing less. It's going to take a revolution that gets rid of this rotten capitalist system, abolishes its economic relations and its institutions of exploitation and oppression, and replaces those with a whole new society with totally different economic and social relations, a society that's in transition to a classless communist world. Now, right now, very important time for those people like me and some others here tonight who see the need for this kind of revolution. But it's also an important time for anybody who's disturbed by having to live in a world where this happens. Somebody who actually thinks about, well, why is it that black and Latino youth get come at by the police like this? Why are they warehoused in prison? Why does this go down? Somebody who learns that 10 million children die every year from things that could be prevented, like starvation or cholera or diseases like that. If you're somebody who's disturbed by that, it's an important time for you, because not only is there a way to break out of these horrors and end it all through revolution, but there's also a way to make that known in a society where that truth gets suppressed. And what I'm talking about is a film that's premiering titled B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And I really encourage people to check that out. Because look, this film is one where Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, addresses the sources of all these horrors. And more importantly, he gets into how they could be ended once and for all through revolution, communist revolution. He speaks to the many great things that previous revolutionary societies have achieved, and also the errors and shortcomings of those previous societies. And he gets into how, on the basis of understanding what those errors were and breaking beyond them, we can go farther and do better the next time power is in the hands of the people. This film, B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less, deals a body blow to the message that the imperialist rulers of this country hit us with from every angle. And that message is that you can't come up with a society that's any better than this hell on earth that they force us to put up with. This film contains the heart of the new approach to revolution and communism that Bob Avakian, B.A., has developed. And it shows the method that he applies to understanding the world in order to change it. So look, if you're somebody who's disturbed by these horrors, who wants to see a better world, then you need to see this film. But even more than that, you need to be a part of making this happen. You need to spread the word to other people.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And you're listening to a talk by Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the title of that talk is Taking the Bullseye Off the Backs of Our Young People.
Now, I want to talk about some of the other ways that we get told we should work to change things. Because I know, look, I'm telling you, revolution, nothing less, is the way out of this, but I know we get told other things are the way to go. And let's talk about one that this has been on my mind, too, because when I went to the protest marking 1 year since the police murder of Romarley Graham, one, I liked the fact that there were a couple hundred people out there. I liked the fact that dozens of us marched in behind the Stop Mass Incarceration Network banner. The one thing I didn't like was the way that people were saying, well, we got to get a new mayor. We got to get a new police chief. That's the way that we're going to deal with this problem. See, now, this view that getting rid of the politicians, getting rid of a police chief is going to deal with the problem of police brutality and police murder, let me just say it. This is played out bullshit. It's bullshit because it doesn't get to the heart of the problem, and it's played out because we did it before. I mean, here in New York, people were very angry, outraged about police brutality back in the 80s. Racist killings here in New York back in the 80s. And one thing that came out of that is New York got its first black mayor, its first black police chief. When those two people went into those two offices, a lot of people was like, okay, now we dealt with it. Now we're going to get these police off our backs. What actually happened was in the months after Dinkins became the mayor, the number of police killings intensified, went up quite a bit. It was almost like they were delivering a message. Don't think anything is going to change by this. And fundamentally, nothing changed. That's what that came down to. See, and the same thing has been true in cities across the country. You get your black mayors, you get your new black police chiefs, you get your Latino police chiefs, and all of that. And that doesn't change things. The police still are brutalizing and murdering our youth. That ain't going to get at it. I mean, and look, we've had this country's first black mayor. He got elected in 2008. And a lot of people were telling me, because I was out there saying revolution is what we need to deal with this stuff. And people were like, no, we celebrate. We've made our revolution. We put Obama in the White House. I was up in Harlem. People were telling me that. I was down in D.C. at the inauguration. People were telling me that. He's going to deal with these police messing with our kids. He's going to deal with the wars. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. Well, I mean, he just got reelected, so he's had one term. What has he done about the way the police brutalize and murder our kids? What has he done about the way that blacks and Latinos are warehoused in prison? What has he done about the way the criminal injustice system comes at people? Not a damn thing. And see, when you get down to this and what it's based on, not only has he not done anything about it, But this has become a further way to beat people down, the fact that there's a black mayor. Because since his election in 2008,
black president,
you're right. Sorry about that. Since his election in 2008, one thing that has been hammered steadily at people is that there are no more excuses. You hear this from right-wing commentators who did everything they could to keep him from getting elected. You hear him from Democrats who were behind him and promoting him to get in. And you also hear this stuff from him. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit, too. And what they mean by that is like, okay, you might be able to say there was some racism in the past, and maybe that held you back. But hey, we got a black president now. We are beyond racism. We put that behind us. So there are no more excuses. So if you can't make it in America, it's your own f***ing fault. They don't say the f***ing part, but that's basically what it comes down to. That's what they're putting out to us. That's what they're saying. And look, Obama piles onto this himself. He piles on with his Father's Day speeches, where he talks about how youth who sag their pants, how absent dads, and how parents who don't turn off the TV and make the kids do their homework are the reasons that black people are lagging behind in the society. That is bull, but even more than that, that is putting the onus on the people being victimized by this society. See, and that's an important thing for us to get.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to a talk by Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, taking the bullseye off the backs of our young people.
Now, I have said many times that Obama and other blacks in these positions couldn't do anything about this if they wanted to, and that they don't want to. Well, let me talk about the first part, that they couldn't do anything about it. They can't do anything about it because this hell is built into the fabric of this system. I mean, let's look at what's gone down over the past few decades as the incarceration rate has increased 8 times. The factories that used to be in this country have been picked up and taken halfway around the world, looking for greater profit for the capitalists who own them, going to countries where they can work people in much more dangerous conditions and pay them far less, and therefore make more profit. What that has meant is that ways to survive and raise a family, legitimate ways, have been removed, particularly from people on the bottom of the society. On top of that, people in the inner cities are dealing with an educational system that's geared to failing the youth. None of this is stuff that poor black people, poor Latino people have done to themselves. These are things that the system has done to them. You get a black mayor, you get a black police chief, you get a black president. What the role that they play is that they preside over the continuing approach to dealing with that problem. And what that approach has been since back as far as Nixon, you know, and in case some of y'all are a little too young to know, Nixon was the president back in the 60s going into the 70s. And he said at a cabinet meeting, this is reported by members of his cabinet, he said, the problem is the black, and we have to devise a method of dealing with that problem that doesn't acknowledge that that's what we're dealing with. This is something that he laid out. And what came off of that is the first modern wars on crime and wars on drugs, which were only being waged in black communities. Then they were expanded to the Latino communities as the Latino population grew in this country. So this is where this criminalization of the youth came from, and it developed along with the deindustrialization of the country. So that's what puts those two things together, and that's not going to be changed by getting a new president. You're going to get a president who's going to preside over, because that's who you get to vote about. That's what we're dealing with. And there are other ways to go at this which come down to the same thing of not getting to the problem. You know, like, well, we can reform it, we can pass this law, we can lobby for this policy, this kind of stuff. But look, it's like I said, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to uproot all the degradation, all the misery that this capitalist system enforces on humanity. Now, this poses for us a question, an important question. What is it that we need to do now to get from where we are to the point where it would be possible to launch an attempt at revolution in a country like this? Now, our party has a statement on the strategy for revolution where it says two things. The first thing it says is spread revolution everywhere. And an important form of that is what I talked to you about earlier, spreading the word on the premiere of this film. BA speaks, revolution, nothing less. That's the way that people are going to get introduced to revolution and to the leadership that we have for that revolution. The strategy statement also lays out that a big part of the answer is fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. See, and what we're speaking to here with that is that people are up against a lot of shit. This system brings it down on them. And when people say, I've had it with this, and begin to stand up and resist, that's when they're most open to grappling with, well, where is this coming from? What's the source of it? What is it that we need to do about it? Who can we join with? Who can we ally with to do it? And it's when they stand up and resist in that way that they're more open to all of this.
You're listening to Carl Dix and his talk in New York City a little while ago entitled Taking the Bullseye Off the Backs of Our Young People.
We've seen this in our Stop and Frisk campaign. You know, like we're going out around Stop and Frisk and people are telling us you can't do nothing about it. Then when we rolled into Harlem with a couple hundred people protesting Stop and Frisk and about three dozen or so of us getting arrested, people in the projects were high-fiving each other. And they were saying, they even had a Jewish dude out there. There was a Jewish dude got arrested. See, and what it was saying to them was, there are other people besides us who don't like this. There are people that we can connect up with when we stand up and fight back. That's what people were getting out of this. And they need to get out of this. What's the source of this problem? And how can we end it once and for all? And that's something that those of us who see the need for revolution have to be bringing to people. Because look, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which I was a part of forming back in July 31st of 2011, it was on my birthday, that's why I remember the date. That network has issued a call for people to act on February 26th. February 26th, 1 year since the vigilante murder of Trayvon Martin. That's an important day to act for two interrelated reasons. One reason is when you look at what's going on with that case, because at the very beginning of that case, they let the killer walk free. People exploded in rage, not only in the area down in Sanford, Florida, but all across the country. So they backed up and said, well, we'll look at this again. Maybe there was a crime committed here, so they charged him with murder. But they still got that stand your ground law, which they used to exonerate him the first time. And there's maneuvering going on that could very easily cut him loose again, either on the stand your ground law or in a trial where the prosecutors who do very well when it's time to railroad blacks and Latinos into prison all of a sudden seem to forget how to prosecute when they're prosecuting police or racist killers like George Zimmerman. The only thing that will, look, we got to make it like we will not stand by silently while you do this. Now, the system might cut him loose anyway. They might go ahead with it. But they need to know that if they do it, they will be doing it in the face of large numbers of people who have not forgotten about this case, who have not gone to sleep about it, who have not moved on to the next thing. That's an important part of why people have to act powerfully on the 26th. There's a call for people to wear hoodies on that day, to take pictures of themselves wearing hoodies, themselves and others that they mobilize wearing hoodies. People need to be a part of that, and they need to be a part of building for that, mobilizing, bringing other people into it. And like I said, there's another reason. Because look, we need to develop a movement of resistance to this hell that they bring down targeting blacks and Latinos around the criminal injustice system. There needs to be a movement nationwide in the tens and hundreds of thousands and ultimately in the millions, because what they're doing comes down to trying to beat down an important section of people and see to it that they can't do anything about what gets done to them. Because they fear, you know, a lot of people say, well, are they doing this because they hate us? And they're actually right. There are a lot of people right in this country who hate black and Latino people, but more importantly, they fear them. They fear what that section of society will do in the face of all the hell they bring down on them. They look back at the 1960s and what happened when black people stood up against what was coming down on them and how that sparked a broader revolutionary movement. They don't want to see that happen again. Well, from our end, in terms of working to build a movement for revolution, we can't allow that section of people to be beaten down, so far that they can never lift their heads and do anything about what gets done to them. Because that's a very crucial section of people for the prospects of making revolution. This is something that the interview that Cornel West does with Bob Avakian. He goes into this thing of what section of this society is going to be an important basis for this revolution. But people need to get hooked up with this move to act on the 26th, and they need to get hooked up with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network to continue to build that resistance after the 26th. Because look, I come at it like we need revolution and nothing less to deal with this once and for all. But if you come in from wherever, if you think this hell needs to stop, then you got to be a part of standing up and saying no more to it. And as we fight together, we can dig into what's it going to take to end it once and for all. And, you know, I was somewhere where Cornel West spoke last night, and I said, well, you know, that brother's a Christian revolutionary, I'm a communist revolutionary. And we find that we act together because we hate injustice. We share that. And I'm working on him. I'm trying to get him to see that, like, communist revolution, not Christian revolution, is the way to deal with this once and for all. Of course, then he said, well, I'm working on that brother on the God question. I don't think he's going to get me on that one, because that's one I've looked into a lot. But look, people need to stand up. They need to fight back. We need to take this on. And like I say, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to take the bullseye off the backs of our youth. People need to act, and to act on their principles. And as they act on those principles, they need to be digging into what is it going to take to lift this bullseye off the backs of our youth and to deal with all the other misery and degradation that humanity is up against today. And I'm confident that a lot of people will see, like I see, that all of this is rooted in this capitalist imperialist system, and we need to get it off our backs once and for all. But we need to be contributing to a day when this idea of a young man with black skin walking along at night wearing a hoodie is seen as a young man with black skin walking along, you know, a young human being who happens to be black walking along with a hoodie, not someone that the police have a green light to brutalize or murder and know with near absolute certainty that they can get away with it. That's the day, that's the kind of situation that we need to be putting our efforts to. And, you know, like I said, I think it's going to take revolution, nothing less.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank Carl Dix for allowing us to represent his speech, Taking the Bullseye Off the Backs of Our Young People. And you may recall that during the speech, Carl Dix talked about a new film premiering very soon in this country, in four cities across this country, in Chicago, the Bay Area, Los Angeles, and New York City. And that film is called BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And it's a film of a historic speech that Bob Avakian gave last fall, and it's not something to be missed. It'll change the whole way you look at the world and perhaps what you do with the rest of your life, so don't miss this speech. And it will be available after the 16th or 17th of March at the site revcom.us. That's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M as in Michael, .us, all right? And I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com.